tell that to my parents?
No, it's
no. Jaime's there. I mean, to be.
The new Mayanote building is for the men or for the women?
I see.
I don't want to talk about it.
Oh, okay.
What do you think?
my guess is you did the phone calls and it's for the men, but then
exactly.
Bobby's
told me they also did phone calls.
I don't know. They did.
They did?
Okay,
good.
Because that would be ridiculous.
Still a little ridiculous.
Maybe they're not good at it.
Yeah, so we should raise money for them?
Okay, sure. Oh, this is chesed. You know, it's
there are potential husbands.
Not mine.
But just like how you're here, he could be there.
Yeah, you didn't know that.
He better be making phone calls.
Okay, I guess we'll wait another minute or so just in case people are coming in.
Do you teach the men's also?
Not at Mayanote, no. I mean, I teach another, okay. Another yeshiva for the men's.
Yeshiva.
Or Sameach, the rival.
Is that your poster that's everywhere?
I didn't hear you.
There's a poster everywhere that says, is it your name?
Well, it depends if it's my name. What name do you... Yeah, my name is around.
It's
a graduate. That's my name. Yeah. I do different things a lot of places. You see my name around. Yeah.
Are you Chabad?
I'm not Chabad. I'm like what you call a friend of Chabad.
Yeah, that's
what
you call.
Maybe Chabad Light. I'm not sure what you call. Okay, so hello everybody, again, coming into the, although Mishenichnas Adar, Marvin Besimcha applies to the first Adar and the second Adar, but as you approach the second Adar, the Simcha ratchets up, so you're actually approaching the greater intensity of the Simcha. You know, they tell a story about a non-Jewish person who converted in a Hasidish community. And Hasidic communities have a lot of Fabrengans, they have a lot of parties, a lot of get-togethers. So he converted at a very auspicious time of year. It was before Rosh Chodesh Shvat. So that's really great. Rosh Chodesh, you have a Fabrengan, Tu B'Shvat, 2 weeks later, Fabrengan. Then Rosh Chodesh Adar Aleph, it was a leap year. And then Purim Katan, you have a big party. And then Rosh Chodesh Adar Beis, and then Purim. And then already Rosh Chodesh Nisan, and then Pesach. Every 2 weeks, wonderful. So he goes over to his friend Ivan and he says, you got to join this religion of Judaism. It's so many parties and drinking and eating. And in between there's a Shabbos too, you know. It's really, really wonderful. So it took Ivan a little time to convert. So he converted after Shavuos. So if you know the Jewish calendar, a lot of things are not so joyous at that point. You know, Rosh Chodesh Tammuz already, and then you have Shavuos Erev Tammuz, and the 3 weeks, and the 9 days, and no meat, and no wine, and no shaving. So he goes over to his friend, and he says, I don't know what's going on. You promised me that we would have parties, like every 2 weeks. And now all there is can't do this, can't do this. The Sfira can't do this. So the first person said, I don't know, ever since you joined, it's been going downhill. The religion has been going downhill. Yeah, so. But there is a point that obviously part of being a Jew understands the rhythm of time. That Shlomo HaMelech says in Koheles that there is a time to rejoice, a time to be sad, that a Jew has to be able to... in fact, that's really, if you think about the ultimate message of the Alter Rebbe in Chabad, and again, the idea, what's Chabad? Chabad is Chachma Bina Das, meaning to say, you don't simply get carried away by your emotions, but you have to try to understand what does Hashem want me to do at this given moment in time, and then the emotions come as a result of your contemplation and your understanding. They don't simply become a spontaneous thing that in which you're kind of a slave to whatever carries you at the moment. So that's why it's been well said by a very great person that if a person cannot cry on Tisha B'Av, they cannot really rejoice on Simchas Torah, because it's all connected. Because if you truly don't miss the Beis HaMikdash, you don't really appreciate the greatness and the goodness of Torah. Right? Because if you appreciated it, you would also feel the void when we're supposed to focus on the void. So the sadness and the joy are kind of interconnected in all of those ways. So be it as it may, we began last week by way of introduction discussing whether or not there's a mitzvah to live in the land of Israel. Now, we actually didn't even get to it because I was giving you an introduction last week about the Rambam and the Ramban, just so you would understand who they were and the like. But without going over that whole introduction, you'll recall that the Rambam's book on Jewish law, right, the complete book of Jewish law, is called Mishneh Torah. And Mishneh Torah means the repetition or the second Torah. Actually, that's what Deuteronomy means, because the Torah itself calls the book of Devarim the repetition of the Torah. Deuteronomy is actually a very, very good translation of the rabbinic name for the book of Devarim, but the Rambam called it his own book, Mishneh Torah. Why? Because the Rambam writes that all you need is the Chumash to know the written Torah, and his book, which gives you every single ruling from the Gemara and the Braisa and the Medrash, and you will know the totality of the Torah Shebal Peh, the written Torah, the oral Torah, Mishneh Torah. That is why the Rambam is the most complete code of Jewish law. The Shulchan Aruch, which was written later, and that includes the Rebbe Shulchan, the Baal Tanya Shulchan Aruch, the Alter Rebbe Shulchan Aruch, only includes the commandments that we keep today. They don't include sacrifices and laws of purity. But the Rambam's code includes absolutely everything. Everything in halacha. Now, the Rambam was criticized for this. There were people, great rabbis, who attacked the Rambam. And they said, what do you mean? Are you telling me we should throw away the Gemara? We don't need the Talmud anymore? All we need is your book? You're saying all you need is a Chumash and your book? And forget about everything else? And who says that what you decide the halacha is should be the halacha? And people criticized the Rambam, etc. But that's the Mishneh Torah. But you'll recall, we talked more about it last week, I don't want to repeat everything, but as you recall, before the Rambam wrote the Mishneh Torah, he wrote a much smaller book. And that smaller book, which is kind of an intro to the Mishneh Torah, is called Sefer HaMitzvos. Have you seen Sefer HaMitzvos? Sefer HaMitzvos is a brief explanation, typically like, you know, a paragraph, of every one of the 613 commandments of the Torah. He doesn't go into the laws, that's left to the Mishneh Torah. So for example, for Shabbos, it'll just say, God commanded us not to do 39 categories of work on Shabbos. That's all it'll say. Now what those malachos are, that's not in the Sefer HaMitzvos, that'll be in the Mishneh Torah, etc. And the Sefer HaMitzvos, it seems, was literally the Rambam's outline for the Mishneh Torah. In other words, the Rambam actually wrote the Mishneh Torah based on the order of the Sefer HaMitzvos. Now, you'll recall that the Sefer HaMitzvos, though, has a bit of an unusual ordering, which may make it a little cumbersome. He separates the positive commandments and the negative commandments, meaning he will describe the 248 positives, and then he will go over the 365 negatives. Now, that's a bit of a cumbersome organization, because often the positives and the negatives are in the same place. Like, say, Shabbos. The Torah says, do not do work, and you shall rest. One is a positive, one is a negative, and yet the Rambam discusses them in different places. So it's a little confusing. Unlike, for example, a later work, which I hope you've heard of, called the Sefer HaChinuch. Have you heard of the Sefer HaChinuch? Sefer HaChinuch simply lists the commandments and explains them in the order that they appear in the Torah. So if the Torah has negatives and positives together, it'll discuss the negatives and the positives. So the Sefer HaChinuch, if you're learning the Parsha of the week, you can look at the Sefer HaChinuch and you'll see a discussion of the commandments that are in the Parsha. With the Rambam, I mean, we have indexes so you can do it, but it would be more difficult to do with the Rambam Sefer HaMitzvos, because the Rambam does not follow the order of the Parshios. In fact, it's a bit of a mystery what order he does follow, because when he lists the commandments and he separates the positives and the negatives, he does not list them in the order they appear in the Torah anyway. And to this day, it's a bit of a puzzle, what was the Rambam's organizational scheme. But be it as it may, you can't simply open up the Sefer HaMitzvos and learn the mitzvos of the Parsha, because you know, you're not going to know which are the mitzvos of the Parsha. So it's a little bit of a difficult organizational scheme. But so that's how he does it. He has positive commandments, he has negative commandments. But the first part of the Sefer HaMitzvos, before he even lists the commandments, he develops a theory of classification, meaning what counts as a commandment, because certain... Remember the problem we mentioned last week was that if you count every time God said do something, every time, you're not going to have 613 do it. You're going to have 5,000 imperative statements or don't do something. So obviously there has to be some concept of classification in which many activities are processes of one thing, etc. So the Rambam tried to articulate, and he's the very first person who ever did this, because Chazal don't tell us what the mitzvos are. Chazal tell us the magic number 613, but they don't give us a list. And before the Rambam, different rabbis tried to make lists of mitzvos. And the Rambam considered those lists to be erroneous and faulty and incomplete. The most famous listing prior to the Rambam was that of Rav Sadia Gaon and the Baal Hil- and the Hilchos Gedolos, Rav Shimon Kayara. These were predecessors. And they didn't explain why they were including things. They just made lists of 613. Right? So the Rambam tried to articulate principles. Okay. Now, and we'll get, the reason I'm mentioning all this is because you're going to see that this will actually be relevant to a niche of Eretz Yisrael, living in Eretz Yisrael. Okay. Now, one other thing, and then we'll get into the substance. Again, this is some much of this right now is quickie review. Remember Ramban, Nachmanides. Okay, Nachmanides was in the generation after the Rambam. Their lives did overlap, meaning the Rambam died when the Ramban was a young man, but they never knew each other. And they grew up in two different geographical milieus and two different cultural milieus. The Rambam was born in Islam-occupied Spain, but the Rambam spent most of his life in Islamic-occupied Egypt. Right, so the Rambam spent his adult years in Egypt, which was a Muslim empire, and Ramban spent most of his life in Catholic Spain. So the Goyim that the Ramban was dealing with were largely Christian, and the Goyim that Rambam was dealing with were largely Islam. That's one thing. The other thing is, of course, that the Rambam died in Egypt. Ramban managed to come to Eretz Yisrael in his last years, and the Ramban actually died in Eretz Yisrael. So although they're both buried here, Rambam is buried here and Ramban is buried here, but the Rambam, Maimonides, was brought here after his death. Ramban was here when he died. Say again? No. Spanish Inquisition is much later. Spanish Inquisition is in the 1400s. That's when it's Columbus. That's much later. The Ramban is the 1200s. There was no Inquisition per se. But what happened, do you recall, is that the Ramban was debating a Jewish apostate who converted to Christianity about Judaism versus Christianity. And the Ramban, so this was a public debate, and people would vote on the winner, like these reality shows, you know, whether it was American Idol or whatever it would be. Not that I've ever seen. Okay. But the thing is that people used to vote on who wins. And the Ramban won the debate, but it was a crime to deface or defame the Catholic Church. So the Ramban was kicked out of the country. And as a result, he had to leave Spain, so he decided he might as well go to Eretz Israel. And you'll recall that the Ramban came to Eretz Israel in the 1200s. And there were almost no Jews here, very, very few Jews here. He says there was not even a minion of Jewish people in Yerushalayim. And the only sizable Jewish community was in a strange place. Not too many Jews there today. That's Aku. You know Aku? Aku is up north near Haifa. And that is where many Jews, relatively, there's a small population there too, but that's yet a few hundred Jews living in Haifa. But there were virtually no Jews in Yerushalayim, no Jews in Hebron. And the Ramban writes in a letter to his family that the holier the place, the more desolate and abandoned it is. And the Ramban did establish a shul in Yerushalayim, which is still standing on its original location, not the original building, and that is called the Beis Knesset of Ramban. Now, it's a little confusing, because Katamon has Beis Knesset of Ramban. I don't know why they call it that.
The old city.
Yeah, but that's not the one. It's the old city. It's the one in the old city that is the one that the Ramban established and the like. One little mystery that I don't know, again, I don't know if I mentioned it last week, is Ramban lived here in Israel, and the Ramban died in Israel. Where is Ramban buried? It's a very strange thing. You know, we identify all sorts of graves of great, great tzaddikim. And we know where the Rambam is buried, right? Where's the Rambam? Everyone knows where the Rambam
Tiberia.
Is buried?
Tiberia,
that's right. The Rambam is buried next to Rabbi Akiva, and next to somebody much later, Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato, the Ramchal, who is a great, great Kabbalist. That was way after the Rambam, and Rabbi Akiva was way before the Rambam, and the Rambam is buried there, but I don't think we know where Ramban is buried, and that's a very, very odd thing, because the Ramban was an extraordinarily great great gadol. In fact, in addition to a great halachic scholar and a great biblical commentator and a great posek, the Ramban was a great Kabbalist. He was actually the first what you might call mainstream gadol, who introduced Kabbalistic interpretations into the Chumash and the like. This is way before the Ari. Again, I don't know if you know all the chronology. I mean, before the Arizal, before all of the Mekubalim came later, the Ramban was one of the first Mekubalim who publicly taught Kabbalah and the like. So why we don't know where the Ramban is buried is a bit of a mystery. I mean, people surmise he might be here or there, but like nobody knows for sure.
Do you know where Rashi is buried?
Yeah, well, because Rashi didn't come to Israel. Yeah, Rashi is buried. We know where Rashi is buried. Rashi is buried in France, Troyes, France. Yeah. I mean, the Gedolim who died outside of Israel, we know where they're buried and the like. It's interesting, you know, I don't know if any of you have ever been to, have you ever been to Poland?
Yeah.
People now go to Poland, although some people are against it because you're kind of giving money to the people who ran the concentration camps. But still, there's so much history and Jewish Poland and great, great tzaddikim buried there and the like. If you go to Warsaw, the Jewish cemetery in Warsaw, is the second largest Jewish cemetery. No, the largest in the world is the Mount of Olives, because that's the oldest. That goes all the way back, you know. But the second largest Jewish cemetery in the world is the Warsaw Cemetery. And what's very, very fascinating about it is you see so many different types of Jews. You know, in the cemetery, there's a section which has the greatest, greatest rabbis, Rabbi Akiva, Eger, the Netziv, like great, great, really, Gedolim. And right next to them, you have these gaudy monuments of people, the founder of Esperanto. Esperanto is a universal language, Edward somebody, I don't remember his name. And then there was a woman that was a very well-known actress in the Yiddish theater. And she did this, like, tremendously ostentatious monument to herself. But it's like right next to Rabbi Akiva Eger, like it's very, very strange. It just shows you that indeed all Jews ultimately get united, at least in the cemetery, if we have a lot of machlokas when we're alive. But one thing that's a little curious is that when you look at the great rabbis who are buried in the Warsaw Cemetery, they weren't from Warsaw. You know, they were from this place. They were like hundreds of miles away. Like, why are they buried in Warsaw? Why are so many great rabbis buried in Warsaw if they weren't even living in Warsaw? The answer is, many, many great rabbis died in Warsaw. The reason is that in the last months of their illness, they came to Warsaw for medical treatment, because Warsaw had the best medical treatment in Poland.
And
clearly not. Well, it was better than the other places. And people died, and according to Halacha, there was some debate, should we send them back to their cities or not, but according to Halacha, there's a very strong preference to bury people as soon as possible. And as a result, many, many, many great rabbis were buried in Warsaw. Warsaw was a great center, even if, I mean, another example, the Rebbe himself, his chasna was in Warsaw, right, if you know the history a little bit. Like, why in Warsaw? They were not, you know, his father-in-law was not living in Warsaw, but Warsaw was a place where, and it was a central place, and if you were sick, you went to Warsaw, if you were making a big wedding, you went to Warsaw, right, so that's kind of how it works. Okay. So we do know where the Gedolim are buried in Chutz La'aretz, but the Ramban's kever is a bit of a mystery. And of course, Moshe Rabbeinu's kever we also don't know, but that the Torah says that no one knows where Moshe is buried. Okay, now, why am I bringing up, again, this is by way of what you might call bibliographical introduction, so you get a sense of the books, so you can place them into perspective. Why am I bringing up Ramban and Rambam? Because one of the things Ramban does is, Ramban, in addition to writing his own works, often comments on the works of others. Right? The Ramban writes points of disagreement or agreement with the works of others. And he often comments on the works of Rambam. And in particular, in the Sefer HaMitzvos. In fact, the Ramban did not comment on the Mishneh Torah, interestingly enough, but he does comment on the Sefer HaMitzvos, and there are times that he disagrees with Rambam's enumeration of commandments. He'll say that the Rambam shouldn't have counted this one, but he should have counted this one, or these two should have been combined instead of separated as two, or sometimes these two should have been separated instead of being combined as one. And, as is always the case when they have discussions, they don't simply express individual opinions, but they try to prove their point, always by reference to Talmudic discussion. Like, whenever these commentaries talk, they never simply say, I say this, and you say this. Well, that doesn't mean very much, but they always go back to the proofs. Now, again, we're not always in a position ourselves to sit around and fully evaluate all of these proofs, but it's all based on various ways of interpreting the Talmud. Okay, so at the end of the Rambam Maimonides Sefer HaMitzvot, Ramban has a long essay in which he says that Rambam left out some commandments he should have counted. Now, keep in mind that if you're wedded to the number 613, anytime you add something, you have to subtract something else, right? And you understand that, because you can't go with the whole list and then add something, because then you get 614. So the Ramban has to manipulate what do you do, etc. But we're not going to go into how he makes up all of the differences. But one of the things he adds to Maimonides' list is he adds a new commandment called Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Yishuv Eretz Yisrael means living or residing in the land of Israel. The Ramban, now Maimonides does not count it. Now we'll see what the implication of that is. It is not on Maimonides' list, but Nachmanides says it should be counted. Now, obviously, if it's one of the 613, you got to find a verse. You got to find a pasuk for it. Where does the Torah say, thou shalt live in the land of Israel? Well, that's a rabbinic teaching, right? That's a rabbinic teaching. But where does the Torah say it? So Nachmanides, Ramban, Rav Moshe ben Nachman, points to a verse at the end of Sefer Bamidbar, in Parshas Masai, in which when God gives us the boundaries of the land of Israel, which, by the way, are much, much bigger than the state of Israel, it says, V'rishtem osa, you shall inherit the land, v'shavtem ba, and you shall dwell in it. Nachmanides says, this is called a positive commandment, called Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. And he makes a number of important points. He makes the point, do not make the mistake that this only applies when we have a Jewish king, like when Mashiach comes. Or this only applies when there's a Beis HaMikdash. But people might say all sorts of things. The Ramban says explicitly, this is Ramban, and remember, I'm going to talk about only one half of the tree here. There will be the Ramban, which will be another view, right? So be sure you're following that most of our shir tonight will be Ramban, but there will be another side. Ramban says this mitzvah applies at all times, at all places. It does not depend on a Beis HaMikdash. It does not depend on Mashiach. It does not depend on a Melech. There is a mitzvah called Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Now, to take this further, Ramban actually says the mitzvah has four subdivisions. So there are four different things you do to do this mitzvah. This is very interesting. So you'll actually see that at least some of the aspects we can even do from Chutz La'aretz. So even if you're going back to America, you can do something. Okay, aspect number one is a collective obligation on the Jewish people to conquer, even by force of arms if necessary, all territory that is within the biblical boundaries of the land of Israel as specified in the Torah. Meaning, all of Eretz Yisrael has to be under Jewish sovereignty and rule. This is our mitzvah. Our mitzvah is that all of Eretz Yisrael. So, if you would follow the Ramban, instead of talking about withdrawing from the West Bank, we would be talking about getting the East Bank, because part of the East Bank of the Jordan was given to the 2.5 tribes. Okay, so that's the first aspect, which means that's not referring to where you live, that's referring to the notion of Jewish sovereignty over Eretz Yisrael. Okay, component number two, remember there are four components. Component number two is even when land is under Jewish sovereignty, it should not be left desolate or undeveloped. There's a mitzvah to cultivate it. There is a mitzvah to make it productive. Now, this could be in a lot of different ways. It could be productive by residential, by people living there. It could be industrial. It could be agricultural. It could be aesthetic, parkland and the like. But it shouldn't just be left as buffer zones or whatever it would be. You do something with it. You know, it's pretty amazing. To this very day, I mean, you know, Ben-Gurion, not that Ben-Gurion is any authority on Judaism, but Ben-Gurion predicted in the 1948s and the 50s that the Negev would be this new thing where so much development would take place. To this day, it's like 70 years, the Negev is still pretty empty, pretty undeveloped. It's amazing how much undeveloped land we have in Eretz Yisrael. This is a small country.
But yeah. It's used for trails.
Well, even that's only a small portion. It's true, yeah, some of it is. But I'm not saying nothing's going on in the Negev. Mm-hmm. But you're correct. I mean, I think Halacha and Ramban would recognize that aesthetics and parkland is considered to be development because that's something constructive. But you don't just leave it empty. Mm-hmm. Now, according to that, by the way, it would stand to reason there's another aspect, and that is anything you do to beautify the land of Israel is making the land more livable and more inhabitable. So when you pick up garbage that you see in the streets, you're doing a mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. When you plant a tree in Israel, when you give, I'm giving a little comfort to the people who are going to live in Chutz La'aretz, when you contribute to Jewish National Fund to plant trees, you're doing something towards Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. You see? Because you're making it more livable, more inhabitable, more user-friendly, etc. That is why, you know, you're not supposed to throw garbage anywhere because you're interfering, I mean, even in New York, I mean, you're interfering with people's enjoyment of the street. But in Eretz Yisrael, it's an extra aveira because you're taking God's land and you're making it uglier. And when you throw away the garbage properly, you are fulfilling, in some way, a certain aspect of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Yeah.
So for the people who donate to help support farmers during trade of the year, yep. Would that be considered?
Yes, yes, it would. Yes, it would. Absolutely, absolutely. But again, these four are not alternatives. You're supposed to do all of them. So even if you, right. So the first one is the obligation to militarily conquer all of our territory.
Could you donate to the IDF?
Well, see, that's a little bit. That's not so much of a chiyuv on me as an individual, but Jewish society has to have an agenda to conquer it. Yeah. Number two is to make the land inhabitable, and that's the JNF and Shemitah and those things. Now, number three is very, very fascinating. Ramban says that the third component is that no matter where you live, even if you live in Chutz La'aretz, you're not allowed in your mind to consider any land to be the national homeland of the Jews except Eretz Yisrael. Meaning, the Jewish nation is not allowed to accept any other country as a national homeland.
So not Uganda?
Yeah, so that's fascinating. What is Ramban talking about? Who's going to think about some other country? But the answer is exactly right. The Ramban was very prophetic here. The Ramban wrote this around 1200. Now, in the late 1800s, when the political Zionist movement began, I mean, religious Jews were always praying that Hashem should bring us back to Eretz Yisrael, but when Zionism became a political movement, so as you know, the head of the Zionist movement was Theodor Herzl. And again, I don't want to badmouth Herzl at all, because, you know, Herzl had no Jewish education. I'm not sure if he had a bris. He may not even have had a bris, etc. He was totally, totally, totally assimilated. And you know the story. How did, of course, he looked like a rabbi with a long, long black beard, etc. And there were people who thought there were religious Jews who thought Herzl was Mashiach, interestingly enough, because he was bringing them back to Eretz Yisrael. You know, they were fooled, etc. But be it as it may, how did Herzl get involved in Zionism? Herzl didn't even know, barely knew he was Jewish. But you know the story, that Herzl was a journalist, and Herzl was covering the Dreyfus trial in France. Have you heard of this? This was a trial in the 1800s, and Alfred Dreyfus was a French military officer who was convicted of espionage, of passing secrets to the enemy. And it was very, very apparent this was a show trial, that in fact the real perpetrators were being exonerated because they were big shots, and this was an anti-Semitic. And everybody who saw this trial saw it was an anti-Semitic show trial. And this shocked Herzl. He didn't realize. He thought, after all, Europe was civilized, Europe was cultured, Europe was modern. Right? This is after the French Revolution. You know, liberté, égalité, fraternité, if I'm pronouncing my French correctly. And Herzl couldn't believe that this anti-Semitism from the Middle Ages was still around. So Herzl said, what can we do about the Jewish problem in Europe? So he came to the conclusion, again, he was not religious, he didn't know anything about Yiddishkeit, but he said that if Jews would only have a country of their own, a state of their own, if they would be like the Goyim with their own country instead of wandering around from country to country, then they would be respected. Then they would be safe. So political Zionism was created not as an attempt to become close to God or to serve Hashem in Eretz Yisrael. It was created as a solution to European anti-Semitism based on the theory of normalization, like the Goyim. And again, I'm not giving you an anti-Zionist speech here at all. I'm just telling you exactly what the agenda was. That's all. You know, there are people who thought that was good. But this is what. Now, here's the interesting question I want to pose to you. If indeed Herzl saw a Zionist state as a solution to anti-Semitism, the interesting question is, 100 years later, is that correct or is that not correct? Again, one can make a lot of arguments about this. Has the state of Israel reduced anti-Semitism in the world, or has the state of Israel increased anti-Semitism in the world? Now, it's true that in the years after the Holocaust, World War II ended in 1945, and there were 6 million Jews that were murdered in World War II. So the world felt sorry for the Jewish people for a few years. And that's how the State of Israel got approved by most of the UN, including Russia, because we feel guilty. 6 million Jews died. But that passed very quickly. And now it's routine. If any of you are familiar with college campuses, it is routine that Israel is often described as Nazi. They're Nazis. And the word Nazism is used to describe Israel as opposed to talking about Jews being victims of the Holocaust and the like. So it's very, very interesting that Herzl's idea that somehow becoming like the Goyim will make the Goyim like us more. The Torah itself predicts that that's not going to be the case. And indeed, it has not been the case. Okay, but putting that aside, therefore, but you understand the following. At some point, the land of Israel, which is called Palestine at the time, was under the Ottoman Empire, the Turkish Empire. And the Ottoman Empire was not willing to give Jews a Jewish state. This is before the British Mandate, right? The British Mandate didn't rise until World War I. But when Herzl was alive, it was the Ottoman Empire. So at some point, Herzl was willing to consider an alternative place for the Jewish state, and that was Uganda. Right? Uganda is in Africa. And he said, no, we'll take whatever we get. Now, based on his premises, that's totally logical. Because if the whole purpose of statehood is simply, we should be like everybody else, so what's the difference if it's Palestine or it's Uganda? It wasn't a question of holiness or serving Hashem or having a Beis HaMikdash.
Why was Uganda up for grabs?
I'm not sure. I have to go back and check. It was a British colony at the time, and Britain was willing to relinquish it. Of course, later we had Idi Amin, many years later, in the 1970s. I don't know if you read about this or the like. A plane with many, many Jews, including some very great rabbis, was hijacked to Uganda, and was kept for a few weeks. So there was Idi Amin. It's hard to describe him. He was absolutely crazy. I mean, he was a brutal person, but almost comical, almost a caricature, like a cartoon character, just a buffoon in so many ways, although a dangerous buffoon. And he was kind of in charge of negotiations. And he talked about the fact that he doesn't know why the Jews hate him. He gave them soap, whatever to say. But what happened was that Israel did an amazing rescue, right, middle of the night, and they rescued the hostages. And the leader of that rescue mission was Yonatan Netanyahu, who was Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's older brother. And he was the only one who died. He died in the raid. So that's Yoni Netanyahu, and that's the raid of Entebbe. Entebbe was the airport in Ethiopia and the like. So what is Ramban saying? Ramban is actually saying it is forbidden for the Jews to look at any other country as their national home. It's almost as if the Ramban envisioned the Uganda thing. By the way, there was even an attempt, I don't know if anybody is from Texas. There was even an attempt to make Galveston Island a place of Jewish resettlement. Now, Galveston now, I think, is united to the mainland. It's not an island anymore. There's a bridge. But Galveston used to be a separate little island, put all the Jews on the... I don't know how many Jews you can put in Galveston.
It's so tiny.
Yeah.
Gaza.
Right. Okay, yeah. Right. So there was some talk about the Galveston resettlement. And even Stalin was willing to create a Jewish state. He was willing to give the Jewish people, the province of Georgia. Not the state of Georgia, but Georgia is, Of course, what happened was, what turned out to be the Jewish state was one province over, Siberia. Jews, because that became where Jews de facto were sent all the time. And the like. Siberia was not a voluntary place, but many, many Jews spent their time in Siberia. Okay, so so I mentioned three components, right, if you're following me. The first component is the military obligation of conquering the boundaries of Eretz Israel. The second is beautifying the land and making it productive, not leaving it what's called shamama. Shamama is desolate and empty. The third is that no matter where you live as an individual, you have to look at Eretz Israel as the Jewish national homeland. So far, so good. So far, these three things I could even do from New York. All right, New York, I give to the IDF for the military thing, and I give to the JNF for the tree thing, and of course, Israel is the Jewish national homeland, even though I have to live in New York. So far, so good. It's the fourth one, though, that kind of hits you where you live, literally where you live, and the fourth one says, and you, me, all of us, as individuals, we are halachically obligated to live here unless we have a reason not to. And I'll get to the unless. The unless is important. So it's not an absolute, it's not an absolute thing. It's not like keeping Shabbos. But you are chayev to live here, chayev, obligated to live here unless. Now there will be some unlesses, and I'll talk about the unlesses. Now again, remember, I have to keep on giving you the station identification here, commercial. I'm talking about Ramban. Remember, Ramban will have a different view. We're all going with Ramban tonight. Yeah?
I'm just wondering, like, where in the text, like, is the Ramban, like, getting these 4 points? Like, where, like, where does he get that part of the mitzvot is, like, to conquer the land militarily?
Yes, because the two words are, there are two words that are used here. V'rishtem osa, v'shavtem ba, right? Those are two words. Now, yirishtem ota'asa means you must dispossess the Canaanite inhabitants. You must dispossess them.
Who did it say
that? Huh? That's in the book of Bamidbar. Yirishtem osa. I'm quoting the Chumash. The Chumash itself says, yirishtem osa. So therefore, this is the an obligation of military conquest. Yishavtem ba is habitation, and you shall inhabit, okay. Inhabit the land. Now, we'll talk about the Rambam's view, why the Rambam doesn't count it. We'll talk about that a little later. Okay. Now, one glaring question you might ask is the following. If Ramban is the one that says you're halachically obligated to live in the land of Israel, then how come he didn't show up until he was kicked out of Spain? The Ramban lived in Spain till his 70s, and then he was expelled after this public debate. So he made his way to Eretz Yisrael, and Baruch Hashem, he came here, and he died here, and he actually wrote his commentary on the Chumash here, or at least revised it. And that's wonderful, but he didn't come until he was forced out of Spain. And that's a little incongruous, right, if he's the one that says, you're obligated, right? So he must have had an unless, right? So we'll discuss what the unlesses might be. All right. So the point that you need to now focus on is the following. Yes, Ramban says it is a mitzvah to live in the land of Israel. Not just a spiritual good thing, which of course, obviously it is, but it's a mitzvah, it's a commandment. But even like Ramban, this is not a commandment that is absolute and categorical. But this is a commandment in which there are some unlesses attached. So let me enumerate halachically what are the exceptions to the obligation according to Ramban. The Gemara tells us there are three heterim, three permissibilities to leave the land of Israel or not to live in the land of Israel in the first place. Now, these are addressed to men, but women can just flip them around. They apply to women as well. The first is, a man is not obligated to live in Israel if it's necessary for him to find a marriage partner, a wife.
Only a man?
No, so that would apply to a woman as well. A woman can leave the land of Israel or not come if necessary for her shidduch. Right? So, marriage is a consideration.
That's why they all go to Crown Heights.
Wherever they go, okay. They don't all go to Crown Heights, but they'll come. Okay, yeah. Now but I'm going to go back because these things can be generalized to broader categories. So the first is marriage. Now, let me point out that this becomes less powerful. You know, there was a time where there almost were no Jews here. I mean, now that there are so many Jews here, you know, it's much easier to find a marriage partner in Eretz Yisrael, but still, people are not interchangeable. You can't just say, come here, marry somebody. You know, go out in the street, you know, whatever, find somebody. You know, if you have a unique connection with somebody, and they're there, and they're not going to willing to come here for whatever reason. So that's a hetzer. Number two, and this sounds even stranger, one does not have to come to the land of Israel if they can learn Torah better outside of the land of Israel. Now, again, that's a little peculiar, but do remember that there were centuries in which there was very, very few yeshivos and Torah institutions in the land of Israel. So, for that reason, you could go out. And the third is economic poverty, if you can't make a living here. Now, I want to show that these categories are broader than they seem. For example, the marriage category doesn't only include, oh, I don't have to live in Israel if I can't find my marriage partner. But it's more of a broad idea of shalom bayis, that if moving to Eretz Yisrael would be a great, great destroyer of domestic harmony and tranquility, then one might be exempt. And similarly, one could even broaden it to family dynamics. You know, this is a major, major issue that people are going to face. Let me tell you now that when you make Aliyah, and I hope you'll make Aliyah, but make Aliyah before you have children or when your children are young. Because if your children are, let's say, teenagers, or not even teenagers, but already 11 or 12, it's very, very hard for them to adjust to a different culture. It's a tougher culture here. You know, they'll come home with a black eye after one day of school or whatever it is. Language is difficult, even if they went to yeshiva from, you know, they don't speak Hebrew like Israelis. So, some people make Aliyah and their kids are 16 or 17. They do it, but it's very, very, very hard. And depending on the kid generally, it may very well be that you don't make Aliyah if that's going to hurt your children. You can't, as it were, be a tzaddik at the expense of what you're doing to your children. So what we're doing is the category of leaving Israel to marry a wife includes the notion of preservation of the family in a good way. Now, learning Torah, this may sound very odd. I don't have to come to Eretz Yisrael if I can learn Torah better in Chutz La'aretz. Why would I learn Torah better in Chutz La'aretz? Well, the answer is it sometimes happens that way, simply because teachers and rebbes and rebbetzins and mashpiyim and mashpiyot are once again not interchangeable. Sometimes you may have a guide or a teacher that is not that replaceable for you. And that is a legitimate cheshbon. Now, maybe it's less of a cheshbon today because you still have Skype and email. You know, even if my teachers are in Chutz La'aretz, I can still connect to them. But it may not be the same, right? It may not be the same, the time zones. So Aliyah is a flexible idea, even like the Ramban, in which one does factor together their spiritual developments and the like. Now, what about the economic thing? So here, be sure you don't let the Yetzer Hara get to you. Because if you define this to mean, if I can't be as comfortable as they have in America, I don't have to move to Israel, then nobody would come to this country at all. Obviously, a certain amount of sacrifice is expected. That's the way it is. But if you're really going to be poor, you really can't make it, you're going to have to beg, that breaks a person, that destroys a person, that takes away a person's self-esteem. And the Torah does not require that you come to Eretz Yisrael if that's going to be your circumstance. Okay, that's an important idea. That if one cannot make a living to support their family, Aliyah is not the problem. Now, the truth of the matter is, I've had cases where people weren't making a living in America. So, if they're not making a living in America, they're not making a living here, they might as well be here. There's not necessarily a problem. But if you're able to make a living in America, and you're not able to make it here, you know, you have to think about this idea of hardship. Sometimes, sometimes people think, oh, life is so hard here. You know, even 20, 30 years ago, it sometimes took a year till you got a telephone. And even that's not a major hardship, but you know, it's an inconvenience. This is before there were cell phones and the like. But today, so they used to tell people who made Aliyah, take a lot of Skippy peanut butter and a lot of toilet paper. People would come in with like lifts of, you know, toilet paper and Skippy and Skippy peanut butter because the toilet paper was rough and the Israeli peanut butter had peanut shells in it, whatever they had. But now, Baruch Hashem, you walk into every makolet, you get Skippy peanut butter and you get Ben and Jerry's ice cream. You know, what are you missing? Even the Chalav Yisrael variety now.
You're still missing the toilet paper.
Yeah, toilet paper. Okay, all right. But you know, things are much, much, much easier. Air conditioning, cell phones, you know, everything is wonderful. So the fact that one is not living exactly like American standards, okay? You know, you give up something. You know, whatever it is. I mean, whatever inconveniences we give up. But as I say, poverty is indeed a burden that Hashem does not require a person to take, because that can break a person spiritually. So the three bases are family preservation, wife, children. The second is spiritual development, learning Torah. And the third is economics. And all of these are connected, because obviously poverty can also hurt the family emotionally as well as financially, and can hurt your spiritual development. Now, there is a fourth heter, which is really more looking at the rabbinical side of it, and this might be the Ramban's reason, and that is, when a person is a rabbi, or even if he's not officially a rabbi, but he's a spiritual influence on others, and he's not really replaceable. If he were to leave, there would be nobody who could replace him in that same way. So that is a heter, to remain with these students and with his yeshiva, or with his kehila, because they need him as a spiritual leader. So, for example, take the Rebbe, right? The Rebbe, for example. Now, the truth of the matter is, we don't know if the Rebbe paskin like the Ramban to begin with, so that may be a different issue. But someone who is a Hasidic Rebbe, someone who has thousands and thousands of people, millions of people, or hundreds of thousands of people, depending on them, can't automatically just shift location elsewhere. And in the olden days, that was especially true when you didn't have communication. Even today, it's true. But think about what it was in the 1200s. No email, no telephones, no computers. The Ramban was the Gadol Hador. The Ramban was the greatest rabbi of the generation. Most of the Jews were living in Europe. So for him to go to Israel, he would be essentially taking himself out of commission. And he didn't have the right to do that for the tens of thousands of Jews. Now this, I will tell you personally, this is a dilemma that rabbis face when they decide to make aliyah. Let's say you're a rabbi of a congregation. Right? I was a rabbi of a shul for many, many years, for 23 years. So this is where you got to be realistic, meaning it is flattering to say, oh, they cannot possibly survive without me. How can I leave them? But then you also have to be realistic. You know, most people can be replaced most times. Right? Now, there are rabbis, let's say of Baalei Tshuva communities, who kind of built the communities from scratch, who really are irreplaceable. And they're actually told sometimes, you know, you can't go to Israel. You got to stay where you're staying. Most of us are not necessarily in that same position and the like. Okay? What did one rabbi say? One said a great thing. He said that whenever he went away for Shabbos or went away in sabbatical, he was afraid of two things. One was the community would fall apart without him, and the other was they would do great. He says he was afraid of both of those things at the same time. Okay. All right. So those are kind of the four factors. Now there's a fifth factor which comes in as well, and that is parents. And that's an important idea. We know, of course, there's a mitzvah in the Torah called Kibud Av V'Aim. And this is going to be, if Baruch Hashem you're fortunate to have parents, this will 100% be an issue in every Aliyah, where your parents will not want you to go. Especially when you get married, and Bezras Hashem, you have your own children. So this is their grandchildren. They're going to say, they don't care about you anymore, but they say, you're going to take away my grandchildren. How is that going to be? All right, so Baruch Hashem, now there's Skype, now there's other things, but still, Skype, not the same. So let me point out that this is a very complicated question. And the reason it's complicated is the following. There are two principles here, but they work in opposite directions. Principle number one is the mitzvah of honoring parents does not override the mitzvah of living in the land of Israel. And the reason that's so is simply because honoring parents never overrides any other mitzvah. For example, if your parents tell you, desecrate the Shabbat, go to the store and buy me something, you don't listen to them. I mean, you decline respectfully. So, kibud avim never overrides a mitzvah, as the Gemara, even though it is a mitzvah, because as the Gemara says, your parents are also obligated to honor God. So the same way, if a parent says, eat this ham sandwich that I made for you, or desecrate the Shabbos, because I'd like you to go to the movies with me, you're not allowed to listen to them. So if they tell you, don't go to the land of Israel, kibud avim, they do not have a veto. That's principle number one. But principle number two creates a complication on that. And that is that if your parents need you, now need is a tricky term, if they need you physically, which can be the case if they're elderly, or if there is an emotional pain or an emotional need that they really cannot live well without your presence. Now again, is that healthy or not healthy? But the point I'm making is that there is no parental veto, but there certainly you have to consider the impact on your parents in making this decision. And that's why you need to talk. It's very, very hard to be objective here, because it's a dilemma that it's very, very painful. And you need to talk to somebody objective, you know, a great rabbi or a great authority beyond yourself to be able to give you guidance in this particular area. Okay, so parents do not have a veto, but you have to take into account the impact on them of your making this decision. Now, Baruch Hashem, today there are ways of interacting, you know, even when you're here, but much more than the olden days, but still, it's still not exactly the same. Okay, so I think I've mentioned a total of, so again, the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael has four components, according to Ramban, and I think we've mentioned six factors that might mitigate against the obligation. One is the preservation of your family, wife and children, finding a wife, finding a spouse, the impact on your children, that counts for one. The other is Lomo Torah, what's best for your spiritual development. The third is poverty. The fourth is if you are a rabbi or a leader of a community, you have certain responsibilities towards the community. That probably was Ramban's rationale. And the fifth is considering parental needs, but not in the sense of kibud avim, because they cannot just order you not to go. You don't have to listen to them, but in terms of their physical and emotional needs, and whether those needs could be serviced from a distance, or even by delegating it to another sibling, or whatever. Okay, so those are things to consider. Okay, but other than that, it is a mitzvah. Now, this is an important mindset, because even according to Ramban, therefore, what comes out of all of this? Not every person is expected to live in Israel. There may be many, many reasons why you don't have to live in Israel. But the point is, you have to ask yourself the question, meaning according to Ramban, there is an obligation unless you have a heter. That's a very different mindset than simply not thinking about it. I mean, the problem is for most religious Jews, I'm talking about religious Jews now, forget about non-religious Jews, for most religious Jews, the issue of living in Israel is simply not on the radar. People don't think about it. They just assume, like they used to say about New York City, nice place to visit, but wouldn't want to live there. There used to be a saying about New York and the like. And you see, according to Ramban, the mindset is very different. I am supposed to live here, unless I have a good reason not to live here. And there are good reasons, so I'm not going to say there are no reasons. There are some very, very good reasons, but you have to have a reason. In other words, unless you go through that process, you are not fulfilling the mitzvah of living in the land of Israel.
But, what religious, Jewish community are talking about? Because I know, within the, Hasidic community, there's, a very strong, anti-Zionism.
Okay, so well, that's the issue. Now, obviously, okay, I'm going to get to that, because here you have to understand that'll be another factor I'll mention in a moment, a sixth factor, that the anti-Zionism is against the state of Israel.
Right, not anti-Zionism.
But it is not against Eretz Israel, and you can be a strong anti-Zionist and still believe that a Jew should live in the land of Israel, even if you're willing for it to be a Palestinian state. For example, go to Mea Sharim, right? Neturei Karta, and we'll talk about that. I'll explain exactly what Neturei Karta is. They are the movement that believes that the state of Israel ought to be dismantled. It is illegitimate. Now, Neturei Karta has branches all over the world. Small branches. I mean, they're very good at getting publicity. But the nerve center of Neturei Karta is in Yerushalayim itself. So clearly, anti-Zionism does not preclude living in Israel, although it makes it very awkward, because if you're really an anti-Zionist, you're not supposed to pay taxes. You know,
why doesn't the government cut off their benefits?
They try to sometimes, but other times, sometimes the government doesn't want a riot of 100,000 people.
Yeah. 100,000?
Well, let me put it this way. There may be only a small core, but they will be supported by sympathizers. But that does bring another reason for Aliyah, and that is, for not Aliyah, and that is, there is a belief that if you consider the state of Israel to be immoral and anti-religious, then one would say it is better to live in Chutz La'aretz, where there's less religious persecution. Meaning, there is a belief among some, this is not my belief, but there is a belief among some that this is a country where it is harder to practice Yiddishkeit than it would be in Chutz La'aretz, because this is a government, again, this is their philosophy, that is trying to destroy Judaism by compulsory military service and the like. Now, you may call that a crazy belief, and I'll elaborate on it, but that would be a raison d'etre. If you have that premise, that would be a reason to say, better not to live here, because I can practice my religion in England or America better than I could practice it here. Again, I think that's patently untrue, even based on their premises, but there is such a belief. Yeah.
What about the belief also within that community, and I'm not so clear on this, but they're against the state of Israel because they believe that making a Jewish state should only happen.
Okay, again, I'm going to get to that, but let me point out one thing. Let me point out that at a minimum, Ramban clearly rejects that idea, because remember, what is the Ramban's first component of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael? That we have an obligation to establish Jewish sovereignty over everything in the boundaries of the land of Israel, and the Ramban says beferish, explicitly, that's even before Mashiach comes. So, you are correct that the Neturei Karta's philosophy is you're not allowed to have a state until the coming of Mashiach. I just want to point out, Ramban clearly rejects that idea, absolutely,
yeah.
You see? Because that's implicit in the first of the Ramban's components. Jewish sovereignty must be established. But your point is a very well taken point. I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit, and that is, you have to remember that Neturei Karta has two very different ideological criticisms of the state of Israel. Criticism number one, whatever order you want to say it is, non-religious, anti-religious, they're trying to destroy Torah. But there's a principle number two, which might even be more fundamental. And they say that even if every single member of the Knesset and the government would be a rabbi with a white beard and payas, and every single thing would be according to Jewish law, totally religious state, they still say it is forbidden to establish a Jewish state until the coming of Mashiach. Right? You get, these are two different problems. One problem is the non-religious or occasionally anti-religious nature of the state of Israel. And the other is, can't have a state at all. They say, in fact, they used to say, even if the Chafetz Chaim became the prime minister, wouldn't make a difference. Couldn't have the state. So you are correct. That's a totally...
And where does the latter belief come from?
I'm going to get to it. I'm going to share with you a very interesting Gemara. Okay, about Gemara and Tzuvos. Yeah.
And then isn't there an issue of once you've moved to Israel, officially moved to Israel, like leaving, you can only leave?
Don't ask that question.
Yeah, well, this is, again, it is said, I'm not sure if the Rebbe ever officially said this, but it is said that the Rebbe was asked, why doesn't he visit, you know, the Hasidim in Kfar Chabad, Kfar Chabad up near Tel Aviv, there's a whole replica of 770. To find a red brick building in Israel is not very common. They actually have a red brick building. I don't know what they did. Chabad has connections. But they actually have a red brick building in the middle of the desert, you know, there, 770. So they really begged the Rebbe to come, and of course there would be thousands and thousands of people that would want to see him. His father-in-law, right, the Friedlicher Rebbe, came to Eretz Israel, right? You know that. He visited Eretz Israel and the like. So what is said is, I'm not sure if the Rebbe himself said it or people are just trying to guess, that the Rebbe may have felt that if he would have come, even as a tourist, even as a visitor to Israel, he wouldn't have a heter to leave. And since he felt he needed to be in New York, he didn't even want to take a trip, because he felt he wouldn't be allowed to leave. But it's hard for me to understand that, actually, because the same heter you have not to go is also a heter to live. I mean, the heter to get married, to teach Torah, applies whether it means you don't move or whether it means you leave. But maybe he felt once he's here it would be more of a denigration of the holiness of the land to leave. That's what people report, but again, I'm not sure if this is a first-hand report or not. But I will tell you that there are many tzaddikim, they will not go outside of Israel even for a family wedding. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, great, great rabbi, a number of his grandchildren got married to women who were in Chutz Laaretz, whatever it is, like London or whatever. He did not go to the weddings. He says he did not want to leave the land of Israel even for a chasna, even for his own grandchild's chasna and the like. They didn't want to leave. And there are people, even more than that, that if they live in Yerushalayim, they do not want to spend a night outside of Yerushalayim. Rabbi Yashub was that way. If you go to Bnei Brak or whatever it is, but they always came back the same night. They did not stay overnight outside of Yerushalayim.
Why is that?
The holy city. They it's not a chi. It's not an obligation anyway. But they didn't want. They wanted to be here. They didn't want to take any time away from being here more than they had to. Now I guess that means you never take a vacation. You never go to Tzfat. I don't know what that means. Only a day trip to Tzfat. That's pretty difficult. You know, 3 hours and 3 hours there, 3 hours back. And you don't even sleep over, and the like. But there was such a hanhaga. The old Yerushalmis, you know, they're old Yerushalmi Jews. It's a point of pride for them that they say, you know, I have not spent a night outside of Yerushalayim, you know, in 70 years. You know, they'll actually tell you something like that. That's what they boast about. That's their big boast, that I've never slept outside of the city and the like. Okay, all right, so now I want to share with you a Gemara in Kesuvos. This is a very, very fascinating Gemara, and it's a very, very important Gemara. The Gemara in Kesuvos talks about the spiritual blessings of living in Israel. Know that it's, that you're with God, etc. Anyone who lives in Israel has a God. If you live outside of Israel, you don't have a God. Now, what does that even mean? What does it mean to say, if you live outside of Israel, you don't have a God? Chas v'shalom. Of course you have a God. So the Ramban himself explains that HaKadosh Baruch Hu runs the whole world, runs the whole universe, of course. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu has malachim, who are under secretaries, just like the State Department, you have the Secretary of State, and then you have the Under Secretary for Asia, and for Africa, and for Europe. So there's the Under Secretary of America, of England, of France, of Germany. But when it comes to Eretz Yisrael, HaKadosh Baruch Hu takes the portfolio himself. HaKadosh Baruch Hu directly runs Eretz Yisrael. So in Chutz La'aretz, you are under what is called the Hashgacha the providence of the mazalos and the malachim, the angels and the constellations. Now you can always pray to God to override, you can, just like you can appeal to the president. So we always pray to Hashem to override those decisions. But the default setting is you're under the malachim and the mazalos. But in Eretz Yisrael, you are directly under the hashgacha of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's the meaning of the statement that anyone that lives in Eretz Yisrael has a direct connection to God. When you live in Chutz La'aretz, your connection is a bit attenuated. It is not as direct. Now the Ramban says that doesn't come without a cost. That is why he says an aveira that is done in the land of Israel is a bigger sin than the aveira that is done outside of the land of Israel, because you are in the palace of the king. By the way, that might be a seventh reason not to make aliyah. Some people say, hey, I'm doing so many aveiros, better in Chutz La'aretz. That actually is a cheshbon that the some Hasidim actually said in the 1800s, that I'm not on a madrega. And that's why the Ramban brings a beautiful raya, and it's kind of scary. Sodom and Amorah, right, the cities of Sodom and Amorah, they were destroyed because of their evil, because of their perversity. Now Sodom and Amorah are near, you know, they're on the Dead Sea, they're relatively near the Egyptian border. I mean, not immediately near, but you know, it's, the Egyptian border used to be north of where it is now. And the Ramban points out that Egypt was certainly as bad as Sodom. Why did God destroy Sodom? He didn't destroy Mitzrayim. Whatever Sodom was guilty of, Mitzrayim was guilty of too. But the answer is, because Mitzrayim was in Chutz La'aretz, God tolerated evil that he would not tolerate in the land of Israel. And that is why the Torah says, when there's abominations in the land of Israel, the land vomits us out. Very, very vivid graphic description. Right, what does God say about sexual promiscuity? He says, behave in a proper manner. Don't engage in the abominations of the land of Egypt, lest the land vomit you in disgust. This is a bit of a scary pasuk, by the way, just generally. Nothing to do directly with our topic. And that is, that indicates that Eretz Yisrael at some point does not allow perversity to exist. The land vomits us out. And it's important to know that people say, oh, there'll never be another Gullus again. Yeah, the answer is that's just not true, because it is true that once this Gullus ends and there's the third Beis HaMikdash, it will never be destroyed again. That is true. We have a promise for that. But we're not out of the second Golus yet. Yes, Hashem gave us a way station. He gave us Eretz Yisrael, so it's a way station. But we don't have Mashiach yet. We don't have the Beis HaMikdash yet. So we're still in Golus. Now you understand, if we're still in Golus, that means we could still lose this land too. Because that would just be intensifying the second Golus that we're in. So, nothing is a done deal. Meaning the idea that God would never allow us to lose the land of Israel, at this point, is a premature statement. God forbid it. It should never, never happen. But in many, many ways, if one thinks about disengagement and this and that, and Jerusalem's up for grabs to make it a divide Jerusalem, Hashem is showing us, little by little, that, you know, things can slip away. Something to be sober. Okay. But be it as it may, so the Gemara Ksuvos talks about the beauties of Eretz Yisrael. In fact, it even mentions a law that no rabbi would tell you to follow today. It says, better to live in the land of Israel in a city who all the inhabitants are idol worshippers than live in Chutz La'aretz in a city where all of the inhabitants are people who keep the mitzvot. So, that would mean, if you asked your rabbi, should I live in Crown Heights or Lakewood or Muncie? Or should I live in Nazareth or Gaza? He would say, well, of course, move to Gaza. No question. It says better to be in a place of non-Jews. Huh?
They're not idol worshippers.
That's right. So it's even better. But it says even if they're idol worshippers. And we wouldn't tell you to do that. Okay. So, in the middle of that discussion in the Gemara, and the Gemara even says when the rabbis would come from Babylonia to Israel, they would bow down to the ground and kiss the dirt and kiss the rocks. There used to be a custom, people don't do it anymore, you know, there used to be a custom when people would land, I mean the very religious people, when they would land on a flight.
I do it.
Did you do it? Okay. Did anyone else do it? Did you notice?
My birthright.
Because I have not seen. I have not seen it.
I got my parents to do it. Well, my mom did do it when she came.
I did it when I came.
Okay. Well, that's appropriate. The Gemara. I mean, it's not done as much. I think it used to be done more. Maybe because travel to Israel is now much more frequent and it's cheaper. Mm-hmm. But when it was a very very big deal, and very few people did it, or maybe only once in their lives. People did it more often, but you're correct, that's the feeling one should have. The Gemara tells us that the rabbis of the Talmud would go on the ground and kiss the dirt, kiss the rocks. So after it goes through that, the Talmud then goes on and it mentions a commentary on the Song of Songs, on Shir HaShirim. Now Shir HaShirim, as you know, is written in a very romantic style. It describes a love relationship between a princess and a shepherd. And there was even a view that it didn't belong in the Tanakh because it was just love poetry. But what did Rabbi Akiva teach us? Rabbi Akiva taught us, if all of the songs of the Tanakh are holy, Shir HaShirim is the holiest of the holy because it is a metaphor. It is using the powerful emotions of love that exist between human beings so we could try to understand on some level the love that exists between God and the Jewish people. So we are the princess and Hashem is the shepherd. And that's how you have to understand Shir HaShirim. So given that metaphorical understanding, which is really fundamental to how Chazal understood Shir HaShirim, there is a certain refrain, there's a chorus that appears three times in the Song of Songs. Because if you recall, there are scenes there where the princess is looking for her lover, the lover knocks at the door, and the princess plays hard to get, and she says, I'm asleep, can't go out of bed now. So the shepherd leaves, and the princess goes out looking for him. And she's beaten and insulted. And they say, what do you care about him for? We can offer you something better. Right? You understand? It's all this imagery of how the nations of the world taunt the Jewish people for yearning to be with God. So there's a chorus that appears three times that she's, not a chorus, but something she addresses to her fellow friends, whoever they are, and she says, Hishpati eschem benos Yerushalayim. I make you swear, daughters of Jerusalem, a Shavua, im ta'iru v'im ta'oruru. Do not stir up, do not awaken es ha'ava, love, ad she'techbatz, until it desires of its own accord. This pasuk appears three times. Very mysterious, very enigmatic. Do not stir up the love until it comes of its own accord. And she makes her friends swear to this three times. What is she saying? What are they swearing to? So listen to the Gemara. The Gemara says, at the time when Hashem destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, He made the Jewish people swear three oaths. Now this doesn't mean a historical event where physical people actually swore. This means in Shemayim, God made the Jewish people, the neshamas of the Jewish people, agree to these oaths. Oath number one, Lo Ya'alu Bachoma. Now Lo Ya'alu Bachoma means they shall not climb the walls. What does that mean? Rashi explains, they will not conquer the land of Israel by force of arms. They will wait until Mashiach comes. Lo yalu b'choma. Yeshvua, number one. Meaning, don't stir up God's love until God is ready. Shavua, number two. Lo yimridu ba'umos. That the Jewish people will not rebel against their host nations. They will be faithful citizens of the countries that they live in. And oath number three, I'm just quoting the Gemara, they will not try to force the coming of the Mashiach before Hashem decrees that it's ready to be here. So again, these are called collectively the three oaths. They will not climb the wall, meaning they will not try to conquer the land of Israel by force. Two, they will not rebel against their host nations. And three, they will not try to force the coming of the Mashiach. Now let me just talk about the third one for a little bit, because you know, you might say, well, what about we want Mashiach now? So the short answer is this. The short answer is that certainly we are supposed to bring Mashiach by good deeds, by Torah learning, and the like. We're supposed to do that. That's how you bring Mashiach. But what the Gemara is referring to is really a process that we really don't understand, and that is there are apparently mystical ways of bringing the Mashiach, even if the world is not ready yet. And essentially what the Gemara is teaching us is that Mashiach is like nuclear energy, meaning to say it's extremely powerful. And if the world is not spiritually ready, it can shatter the vessels and destroy us, because it is a light that our utensils are not strong enough and not thick enough to be able to absorb. So that's why the Rebbe always had the line. What's the line? That will bring Mashiach through good deeds, through Torah. That's the important thing. Meaning it's not an automatic thing. Even though the song, okay, I have a catch on the song. The song still doesn't seem to, we want you now. Okay, I'm not going to address the song per se. But the point basically is that for us to be worthy of the Mashiach, we have to be spiritually ready for it as well. Now, the Gemara itself seems to contradict the Ramban, and that is a good kasha. But I just want to point out that this Gemara of the three oaths is the basis of Neturei Karta philosophy, that it is absolutely forbidden for the Jewish people to establish a Jewish state before the coming of Mashiach, because we took a solemn oath to the Almighty that we will not try to conquer the land of Israel in a military way. Now, Ramban, well, we'll talk about this next week. The Ramban obviously did not accept that, either didn't accept that Gemara or didn't accept that interpretation. But this is the basis of the Satmar Rebbe, this is the basis of the anti-Zionism. As I say, anti-Zionism is not only based on the secularism of the state, it's based on the very idea that statehood is wrong until the coming of Mashiach. Now, what is the ideological basis for that? That we look at Golos as a divine decree. God decreed that we be in Golos. And when one tries to end the Golos by establishing a state, one is rebelling, this is their philosophy, one is rebelling against God, one is contravening God's divine decree. Now let me point out that although this might be a minority position today, now we associate it with the Neturei Karta, in truth, this was once a much more widely held belief. For example, Rav Shimshon Afal Hirsch of German Orthodoxy was against the idea of statehood. If you would go back to 1947, many, many great rabbis were not in favor of a state of Israel, because they thought it would be a violation. Even Chabad. The Rebbe Rashab in the 1920s was against the notion of a state. And the reason why Chabad went over to the state afterwards is not because statehood was inherently a good thing, but rather once you have millions of Jews here, you have to protect them. It's kind of a de facto situation in which you can't abandon Jews and leave them in danger. But had we been able to turn the clock, there are many people who argue, based on this Gemara, that one should not have a state. And it's not so simple. Meaning, pragmatically, once you have millions of Jews, you can't abandon them. Only the crazy Neturei Karta says, dismantle the state, make it Palestinian. But Lechatchila, back in 1948, maybe not, you know, maybe not. Now, let me point out, though, that there are a number of questions on this position. And that is, you're telling me it's wrong to have a state because I'm trying to circumvent God's decree of Galus. Well, let's consider sickness. A person gets sick. We don't say, going to a doctor. No, Christian scientists say, you're not allowed to go to a doctor. Because Christian scientists say, if God made you sick, all you're allowed to do is pray to God to make you better.
You're talking about Scientology.
No, this is called Christian science.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Mary Baker Eddy, I think. Yeah. Now, we don't say that. We say the other way around. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu commands us to seek medical intervention, knowing, of course, that he's the source of healing. So the question is, so to say, because Golus came from God, we're not allowed to do anything to take ourselves out of Golus. That I think would be inconsistent with the way we approach sickness and other phenomena. Let me point out as well that those who don't accept Neturei Karta, they make the following argument. They say, the oath does not say thou shalt not make a state. The oath says you shall not establish a state by military conquest. So here's the argument. The state of Israel was not established by military conquest. Let's go over some of the events. After World War I, the Ottoman Empire kind of dissolved. Even Turkey became a republic. And Palestine, which included Jordan, became part of a British mandate. Now, in World War I, the British government issued what is called the Balfour Declaration, which actually said His Majesty's government recognizes the right of the Jewish people to have a state. So the concept of a Jewish state was authorized by the nations of the world and later by United Nations resolution in 1947. And if we needed to fight a 1948 war of independence, that was not a war of aggression. That was a defensive war because we're attacked. So the counter Neturei Karta argument is that the state of Israel was not established by military conquest. The state of Israel was established by international recognition. And again, that means we're not on the Madrega yet for a Mashiach, so we needed the recognition of the nations of the world. That's an inferior thing, of course. But that's exactly the point, that we did get the Haskama of the Ummot, and whatever wars we fought were defensive in nature. That's one argument against the Neturei Karta position, which would legitimate a state. And there's a second argument that is said, and that is, if you look at the Gemara further on, after the Gemara says the Jewish people made three oaths, it then says that God made the nations of the world make one oath. And their oath was, they will not oppress the Jewish people excessively. So there is a package deal. We'll be good, we'll be passive, we'll be obedient, we'll be submissive. We will not wage wars to establish our state, and they will treat us with kindness and compassion. Well, you know, when two sides make a contract and one side commits what is called a material breach of the contract, that releases the other side. So here's the argument. Yeah, we made an oath. We weren't going to conquer. We weren't going to establish a state on the condition that they do not oppress us. But whether it's crusades, whether it's pogroms, whether it's inquisitions, whether it's the Holocaust, whether it's Islamofascism, they certainly did not live up to their promise. Therefore, we are released from our oath. Okay, so what I'm trying to show you is, number one, the theological basis of the Naturae Cartas position and how the other groups in Judaism answer that. Okay, you see? It's based on this Gemara in Kesuvos. The Satmar Rebbe, Satmar was really a great exponent of the anti-Zionism idea, based his whole ideology on explaining this passage of the Gemara. It's called the Three Oaths. It's a very, very famous passage. And if you go to Naturae Cartas' websites, you'll see it explains in great detail, but they won't give you the other side. I'm giving you the other side of how we can interpret it differently, that the State of Israel was not established by war. The war was defense. The State of Israel was established by international recognition and the Balfour Declaration and the United Nations resolution of 1947 and the like. Okay, so this is now, what does Naturae Carta mean? Naturae Carta is Aramaic. It's not Hebrew. It means guardians of the city. That's all it means. And Naturae Carta, it's not such an easy movement to define, because it is not like a... Meaning, you could be a member of Naturae Carta, but you can also be a chassid who has another rebbe. You could be a satmer, you could be a toldos aron, you don't even have to be a chassid. You could be a brisk a person from brisk. Meaning, Naturae Carta is not the definition of your whole religious identity. It kind of just means you could be a gerer chassid, but your Zionist orientation is Naturae Carta, right? So Naturae Carta is really only referring to a narrow issue. And Naturae Carta is a relatively small group, but they're vocal, and they have their own newspapers. And now, even within Naturae Carta, there's a lunatic fringe and a normal fringe. The normal fringe just says state was wrong, there shouldn't have been a state, etc., etc. That's fine. But the lunatic fringe are the people who meet with Ahmadinejad in Iran and say there wasn't a Holocaust or whatever. That already is a crazy group. And even Naturae Carta disowns those particular people. You have to understand that sometimes the people who get the biggest publicity are not legitimate spokesmen, even for their own extreme group. Naturae Carta is a fairly extreme group, but these are extremists that even Naturae Carta considers to be too extreme, right? So you have to beware not to be taken in by the newspapers and the like. Okay, you all be well and enjoy the month of Adar.
Thank you. Which Gemara is it?
This is Kesuvos 111, Kuf Yud Aleph.
And where was the story that you told about the princess? Where is that from?
Oh, that's Shira Shirim. Yeah, Shira Shirim. So when you look up the Gemara, you will see that verse quoted. So you'll actually see where it is. That verse appears three times.